Hi, I'm Richard Campbell from .NET Rocks and Ronaz Radio here at Build in Seattle. And we're talking a little bit about .NET, past, present, and future. And I'm with a collection of troublemakers, actually. ladies first, Beth.
Hey, I'm Beth Massey. I'm the product marketing manager for the .NET platform, but a longtime community champion and developer from .NET, for sure.
Absolutely.
She used to be on the .NET team. And you're still,
I'm still on the .NET team.
Yeah, but deep down, she's still a Fox pro person. We don't talk about that, but that's the truth. Mads.
Yeah, I'm Mads Torgerson, and I'm a program manager on the C# team. I guess I worked my way up to become the lead designer of C# and pushed Anders out.
You shepherd the language well, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate the work you do.
Shepherd is a good word.
Yeah, you have a style that makes me think you should of shepherding too. I like that a lot.
Much appreciated.
Mr. Hunter.
Scott Hunter, Director of Program Management at Microsoft on the .NET platform. Started in 2007 on the ASP.NET team, and now working on the whole thing.
Yeah, and I think most folks who follow .NET Rocks are aware that I've been working on a book on the history of .NET, and so I've certainly had conversations with all of you and many others. It's a big, complicated story. It's gone for quite some time. So I happen to know, because of our conversations, that you were a .NET developer before you ever worked for Microsoft. I mean, that was your business.
Yeah, actually, my introduction to .NET was kind of funny. I just sold a startup in California, and I wanted to give my engineering team a treat before we actually left the company. And so I flew my team down to Orlando for the 2002 PDC.
Right. So that was the shipping of .NET.
It was the shipping of .NET.
Yeah.
And Scott Guthrie was on stage introducing .NET. We all got this huge box of floppies, and we're sitting in our hotel room on the floor that night, shoving disks in. We were all Java people before, and we're like, oh, this is amazing. And that was my, from that moment on, I was like, okay, we're moving from Java to .NET.
To .NET. That was your moment. And I've since acquired a bunch of original marketing materials from 2002, and the tagline was 22 languages, one platform. And it was a corollary against Java, which was any platform, one language at the time. And of course, neither are true anymore.
I don't think we ever got 22 languages. I don't know how many
I found the list. Some of them are strange.
But it's weird. Even though we didn't get 22 languages, I was just talking to some folks 2 weeks ago that were working for a bank in Europe, and they were helping the bank. Mainframes cost a lot of money.
Yep.
And they want to move off the mainframe onto PCs, even if it requires a lot of PCs because it was cheaper. And so that was a COBOL app running on the mainframe. They ported the app to COBOL.NET that runs on .NET Core.
I checked the gallery recently. They still sell COBOL.NET. It's supported by Fujitsu. IBM's supporting a Fortran.NET, to this day. So some of those languages from that original 22, they're still out there.
Those two, I'm not surprised. Because as you said, if you want to move off of an expensive mainframe, these are great ways to take the exact code you have on the mainframe, move them to a modern platform, run them in wherever you want. So I'm not surprised those are the ones that are
still in
surviving.
There. So I love that you came from Java, because I know you came from Java too.
You did. Which one of us?
I know you're Java.
Okay.
You're Fox Pro.
I was all Fox Pro. I didn't do Java at all, actually.
The story I heard, I think Anders told me this story that you probably mentioned as well, is seeing you present about, I think it was Wildcards for Java?
Yep.
In Denmark.
Yes.
And going, that's the guy. We need that guy.
Oh, I like hearing that from his side. You see, I think serendipity really kicked in there. I was kind of sick of my current job, and I went to that conference specifically with a mind to looking for something else to do that was more industry-focused. And I was there presenting on Java generics, and Anders was there presenting on C# generics and .NET generics. And it was like, wow. They're doing it so much better than we are in Java. And we got talking.
I think it's a very interesting piece that I'm a long way from finished writing in the 2005 timeframe. The planning for generics in .NET, I mean, it started back in 2000. Mm-hmm. And Don Syme, the father of F#, who's on my list to get to as well, he was heavily involved in that early thoughts on generics and all of the potential around that really didn't come true until version 2, until 2005.
That's true. Long as the process was in .NET, it was actually much longer in Java. But they kept arguing about it, and .NET. I was an intern at Microsoft Research in Cambridge, UK, mm-hmm. in 1999. And they started talking about generics, and they were talking about .NET before it even became .NET,
right.
and generics, and it was all very secret. And I was sworn to silence, and I kept that with me for years and years until I rejoined Microsoft.
Interesting. So you had seen it in 99 as an intern,
yeah.
and then you see it again in, I guess, 2005 in Denmark.
And it's really blossomed into something very cool.
That's really interesting. And it, for the hardcore comm sci type person, that time span and that work that was done that really set the foundation for what C# could be and what
yes.
.NET could really be.
Yeah.
We're still reaping benefit from that to this day.
We are. I had the pleasure of giving a talk at the JVM summit about half a decade ago, where they were discussing all the things that they did wrong, and I was invited to essentially shake them up and say, you know, we gotta do better generics, because the way we did generics by building it deeply into the runtime, that really became a foundation for link in C#3, for
yes.
dynamic in C#4, for async in C#5. We could not have done any of those things if we hadn't done the sort of really deeply embedded reified generics the way we did it in .NET. And so I think you mentioned Don Syme, Andrew Kennedy as well, those
yes.
two from Microsoft Research, the work that they did. They didn't actually just help with birthing it. They were in the process all the way up through code reviews and inserting into the source code for a very long time. They really deserve a lot of credit for generics.
And I would, you know, today we have the advantage, because you do most of this work in GitHub, that we can actually look at the debates that you're having.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would love to be able to read, if they still existed, the debates from 99, 2000, 2001, when you're really almost speculating, because there is no great generics example to model from at the time, about what this could do, why we would want it, and the fact that 10, 15 years on, it would still be important.
Let's see if I can help you with that.
I'd love to. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. Beth, I was a Clipper guy.
I was too, actually, before
you're a Fox person as well.
Summer 87.
And of course, the big thing, yeah, fall 86, you know, beautiful tools. Simple things. But the big thing for me where FoxPro really emerged was that integration into Studio, or rather not integration into Studio. It was just in the box. VB had its own editor. C++ had its own editor. Fox had its own editor. The only thing that was actually integrated in Studio in those early days was J++ and InterDev.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I think I got into FoxPro because of Clipper. It was just DBase. Our company needed to move. They wanted to be multi-platform, right? So we wanted to, instead of just have a DOS-based system, we really wanted to hit, you know, Mac and Unix
mm-hmm.
at the time. So I'm like, how about FoxPro? It had four platforms at the time,
yeah.
right? Windows, Mac, Unix, and DOS. And it was like a no-brainer for our company to move to Fox, because we literally just recompiled the code.
Right.
That was porting DBase back then. Just a different compiler, the same exact language constructs. And then when Microsoft bought FoxPro, we added, you know, a bunch of object-oriented programming concepts. So I think I got like a jump start learning object-oriented programming in a way. Never really got into Visual Basic 6 at all. There was
right.
always a debate between FoxPro and VB6. You suck, no, you suck, no, you suck, right? So
yeah. We were both productive. We
yeah.
didn't get along that well.
So I think once, and I was speaking, actually. I was a FoxPro speaker.
Right.
I was going to conferences. And then when .NET came to be, we were on like betas of C#, alphas and of C# kind of thing. And I was like, I don't know if that's this language. It's not, I don't really feel like it's me, honestly. Like, I really was a FoxPro developer. So I actually got into VB.NET, and I programmed VB.NET for many years.
So avoided VB6, but went to
yeah,
VB.NET.
Yeah, it was like, change this to me, and you got FoxPro. But you know, FoxPro was in-memory database manipulation, right? So you didn't have that. We were moving towards, towards the internet here.
Mm-hmm.
We were moving towards distributed systems. FoxPro had a limit. You know, it was really good at client-server apps.
Yeah,
but
what it was for.
It wasn't very good at distributed apps. I mean, you could get it to work, believe me. I did a lot of work doing that. But once I saw the performance, actually, of .NET, I was hooked, literally hooked. I started writing more web applications, but not web front ends, but like service kind of based applications, Com+, you
right.
know, that kind of thing, distributed applications. And I just remember going, I'm never using FoxPro again. I'm sorry. I ended up on the Fox Pro team for a while, actually, though, so it was kind of like
just this to make it even more
full circle, right? Yeah. But yeah. But I learned a lot about community from that community, and I learned a lot about giving back and teaching, and because that's how I kind of got into speaking about Fox Pro. I wanted to teach people like what I knew, you know.
And there's one of those secrets about being a teacher and educating others, where you really have to learn things thoroughly.
Right.
Like it makes you a better dev,
right,
and makes you a better community member because you're committing to what it takes to teach effectively.
So I always had the passion for programming. When I started programming, BASIC was my first language,
sure,
when I was 8 years old, you know, on an Atari 400. So yes. I mean, I always had that
too.
Passion.
Yeah.
Yeah, Atari 400.
Maybe. KRS-80.
Yeah. So I think my .NET career was full of just being really passionate about the community and getting people to love the platform like I love the platform. And now the job that I have in marketing is still very similar to that. I love the platform. It shows, hopefully it shows in all of the marketing that you see around .NET. I hope I keep it real. And I just want everybody to understand the platform and embrace it like I did. So.
And all of you have been with Microsoft long enough to have gone through this shift from that original, this is a multi-language place all about Windows, to the transformation into open source cross-platform. I think I teased you mercilessly on .NET Rocks a few times about Roslyn being like fusion power. It was only a couple of years away from shipping over and over. It took a while.
It did, but did we come through?
Yeah. But you didn't set, when you started Roslyn, it wasn't with the intent to be cross-platform open source, right? It was really writing C# and C#.
Well, it was definitely with sort of a mind to go open source if the time would allow by the time we shipped. So we
right.
did have that in the back of our minds. You know, made sure to keep the code nice.
Right, yeah.
And presentable. The cross-platform, I think, was happened more in parallel. It turned out to be a really good thing because Roslyn was rewriting the C# compiler and language service in C#.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that C# started being able to run on other platforms means you can run Roslyn on other platforms, means that you can better support C# in IDEs and tool chains that run on different platforms, right?
Right.
So it kind of worked out together so that you now have, you know, Visual Studio for Mac, for instance, and you have Emacs integration and C# running all sorts of places now.
Yeah, just sort of appearing all over the place. I know I saw Glenn Block run around here at Build, and of course he was involved with the whole C# scripting thing.
Yes.
And just another, as soon as he started thinking about C# outside, even of the .NET context, and outside of certainly the Windows context, mm-hmm. Those were early days when they were doing those kinds of experiments, and certainly Roslyn suddenly made that blow up. And as much as I teased you early on, I do remember us doing a show in Norway, I think, or maybe it was London, where I said, we're about to have a Cambrian explosion.
You said it both times, actually.
Yeah, probably, quite possibly. It's a good line. I'm going to use it more than once.
Yeah.
But you know, the side effect of Roslyn and that reorganization of the way this sort of compiler's a service mindset just opened the door to all of the things we're now seeing.
Right. And I think that it speaks, again, to the people who engaged with .NET and C# very early on, mm-hmm. who built who laid the foundation of it, that it was so easy, in a way, to retarget it away from Windows. Like, it wasn't, even though it was targeted for Windows, it didn't have a bunch of Windows-isms in it.
Right.
It wasn't, like, tied at the hip in a way that needed complicated surgery so much as being conceptually kept separate, and C# as a language certainly, and most of .NET, the .NET framework, were relatively easy to take to other places intact, if you will.
Right.
So there's a bit of foresight there. I don't know if it was just good hygiene or they actually envisioned some time being and other operating systems, but there was a really good tone set from the start that we don't just, like, we don't put Windows directly in people's faces.
And part of it, I wonder often, is it actually Conway's Law? The fact that there was a CLR team, and there was a languages team, and there was a BCL team, like those, that separation meant that there were sort of clean abstractions between what was Windows and what wasn't.
Yeah, as much as we could.
Yeah, I think it worked out.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously, you got the language really living on its own in the form of Roslyn, and then this is where you've got huge amount of work getting core, basically a rewrite of .NET.
Yeah.
Why? Why rewrite it? Why not just open source what was there?
I think the big thing, you know, the whole .NET Core wave was realizing a couple years ago that the landscape for programming was just changing. Mm-hmm. You know, being somebody that came primarily from the server side, ASP.NET background, you know, for us, the world had completely changed. All the competitors were open source. All the competitors ran cross-platform. I mean, we'll get into a little bit of history of .NET here by doing this. I don't mind laying it out there a little bit. So you know, we had kind of identified that the only way to survive as a product was we had to show that we were open and cross-platform. And at the time, the ASP.NET team was actually in the Azure team. There was not a combined .NET team like there is today.
Right.
And we wanted to prototype having a version of ASP.NET. It wasn't called Core at that time. It was just ASP.NET 5. And we didn't have a cross-platform CLR. So we actually grabbed Mono.
Right.
And we had our bits running on Mono, and we actually went and we had decks, and we went for about a year, and we'd go around and show these bits to people, and show here's a totally side-by-side .NET. It's got a very simplified project system. It can be used from any editor, whether it's Visual Studio or VS Code or Emacs or Vi or whatever. And the reality is, it resonated really well with the public.
Interesting.
In some ways, I want to think that we guilted developer division into giving us a cross-platform CLR.
But I think the fact that you guys were tied to Azure, and Azure only wanted to sell compute, and so they were, I mean, from the day one with Azure, there was PHP and Java, and as well as .NET and the other. So, you know, Azure was always cross-platform.
Right.
You guys were just extending
and
that.
But we kept hearing Linux and containers didn't exist on Windows at that time, and so we just saw this wave happening that we were not going to take part of. Mm-hmm. If we did not find a way to join that wave. And we, you know, we did some bad things and good things. I mean, I'll be honest with you, we wrote the project system, wrote our own project system.
Right.
That's always a bad thing. Because the reality is that project system will not work with WinForms or WPF or class libraries or all those kinds of things. So it was an incompatible world. But I think it was enough to kickstart the developer division and other parts of the company of saying, hey, maybe there is something here. You know, you could go back and talk to the Visual Studio Product System team, and they'd go, there's nothing wrong with it. Well, there's 500 lines of XML.
Right.
So? if you only
they
use
said that about SOAP.
If you only use Visual Studio, that's fine.
Yeah, but when you start looking in a broader world.
But you start trying to, you have a Node developer get on stage and write their first Node app in 4 lines of code.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, first type in the 600 lines of XML, and then write 4 lines of code.
Nice.
That's kind of how the core wave started. It was first ASP.NET 5, which became DNX, mm-hmm. Which then became .NET Core.
Right.
Over a generation.
Now, was there a concern at the time about a schism between the original framework, which we call standard framework these days, and this new core stuff? Because they weren't the same, and they were also sort of appealed to different audiences as well.
I think there was a fear of that schism happening. But this is kind of where being in separate teams was not exactly the healthiest thing.
Right, part of the challenge.
Server teams, like, we want to do server stuff, we want to be awesome on the server.
And it competed that level with these people.
In some ways, it was competing with the .NET team, as the .NET team was still, you know, in part of Microsoft.
Right.
The cool thing was, you know, we all recognized that. In some ways, I think it all, in the long run, turns out to be better for everybody.
I thought that the move to standard was such an interesting idea. Rather than having one way to do things and, say, one team controlling all that, to sort of have this meeting of the minds and say, we're going to all comply with this set of APIs and work this way so that you can each build independently to that point.
.NET standard is got a funny history as well. The ASP.NET team had just merged into developer division, so we were back to being one full .NET team again.
Yep.
And what had happened is, it wasn't public yet, but we knew that at Build, we were going to announce Xamarin.
Right.
Being acquired.
Yep.
And we're all sitting in a room going, what are we gonna do? We have Mono, we have Core, and we have .NET Framework. We have three different frameworks. And there's not a good way to share code against these things.
Yeah.
And in some ways, we kind of knew that the ask was going to come, whether we self-figured out how to do it or we did it ourselves. Mm-hmm. If we didn't find a way to play well with the Xamarin stuff, how could Xamarin be successful
sure.
if you can't share code from a .NET Framework app to Xamarin or a .NET Core app to Xamarin? That is a fundamental requirement for the platform. And so .NET Standard was born out of knowing there's no way that we can suddenly take three frameworks and merge them into one.
No.
I will say, as a team, I would love to get to that place. To me,
one .NET.
Yeah, historically .NET is, you know, we made many, many .NETs, way too many. I mean,
a lot of XAMLs too, right?
Too many UI frameworks.
Yeah.
For .NETs, we have .NET Framework, we did .NET Compact, we did Silverlight, mm-hmm. ad nauseum on and on and on, and they were all different. And we had ways of sharing code before called PCLs.
Yep.
Portable class libraries, but they were kind of exclusionary. The more frameworks you checked, the smaller the intersection became.
Yeah, and this sort of n over n minus one problem. Like, it's just a multiplier where it gets harder and harder to do anything as the platforms increase.
But the .NET Standard, I think, was successful. It's in the product today, and I think the biggest success of .NET Standard was when the Windows team recognized that for UWP to be successful,
right.
had to support .NET Standard as well.
Sure.
And that unified the entire world with all our .NETs, all with the same APIs.
So they all can, and not perfect code portability, but if you know how to program one, you're going to be successful with the others.
Right.
Like, it's good.
But it literally just came out of, oh my God. And at the same time that it came out was when we realized we have to simplify .NETs.
Yep.
And we have to make it easier for your code to move across all the .NET. Those are the two things I think the team cares about today. Simplify and make it easy to use all your code anywhere you want to use your code. That's the two things that I hope the team internally is thinking of all the time. Our stuff's still too complicated. I mean, seriously, if you install the latest Visual Studio today and run .NET --info, the screen that will come out of that will scare you.
It's a lot.
Because you'll find you have like 20 versions of .NET Core on your machine. So we're working on that too. But we will continue to work on simplifying and shrinking down to one thing.
Absolutely. And yeah, I'm going to throw this question at you from Stuart Quinn, who put it out on Twitter. Will .NET Framework 4.8 be the last one? Will there never be a 5? It doesn't seem like there's much need now with your recent announcements around Core 3 and a version of WPF and WinForms running against Core for Windows. So now that there's desktop apps on Core, will there ever need to be a Framework 5?
I don't think there'll ever need to be a Framework 5, but I don't want people to believe that because there's not a Framework 5. We ask ourselves internally the same question.
Sure.
What would make us call it a 5?
Right.
What big fundamental change do you make in .NET Framework to make you call it a 5? I think what would have to happen there would be there have to be some new workload that doesn't exist today
right.
that we bring into .NET Framework. You know, historically, we brought things like WCF in, Entity Framework in,
yep.
and each of those had major versions, 3.0s and 3.5s and 4.0s, when those kinds of events happened. Or there'd have to be some crazy language feature that rippled through the entire framework and we put everywhere.
Isn't C# now perfect once async and await? Like, there is nothing left to do, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it's totally it's totally stable.
Well, I wasn't going to go as far as stable, but
stable. No, that could certainly be big things. But, yeah, I agree with Scott that, you know, we've been very, more so with .NET than with C#, as you can tell by the lower version number. We've been more careful to rev the major version of .NET to where it really mattered. And so that's
the basic measure of a first number, a breaking change, like that you should expect that your code's just not going to move.
In .NET, we never actually even made a major version be a breaking change.
No.
For the most part. It tried to be as compatible as possible.
Yeah.
It would always try to upgrade your project, and in most cases, it would. You had to do exotic stuff for it not to work.
I think it was one of the
challenges. In the .NET Core world, we don't feel the same way.
Right.
Because .NET Core is not globally installed, and there's only a singleton on the box.
Yeah.
We do think that in a move from a 2 to a 3, we could make some breaking changes. And that's not saying we're going to go do the goal's not to. But if we had some major mistake that we need to remove, I think we would actually remove it now.
Sure.
Not let it just live in the system forever.
Like I remember these debates around Roslyn where it's like, this is actually a bug in C#, the old version, but we found people that are counting on that bug.
Yes.
Do we fix it in this new version, at this rewrite?
We ported a lot of bugs. And that's true. I mean,
yeah.
we found that behavior was wrong in a certain way, and it was really, if there's anything that's harder than porting the exact right behavior, it's porting the exact wrong behavior.
Love it. Yeah.
It's really, really hard because what is the semantics of some weird, like, little bug you do? I mean, how do you make sure that the new code in another programming language, in another architecture, it behaves exactly the same as some, like, random fallout?
Unintentional behavior in the first place.
I'll give you a great example of this. In the demo I showed at the .NET overview today, we showed a .NET Core application and a .NET Framework application that would basically enumerate the files in your hard drive and draw a pie chart on the screen. Now, the funny thing is, the .NET Core version is a little different than the .NET Framework version, and I'll explain why. In the .NET Framework, if you start enumerating from C drive, the file enumeration APIs will fault and throw an exception as soon as you hit a folder you don't have access to.
Oh, they check in ACLs.
But they shouldn't, because how would you know? You wouldn't know that exception's there or that you don't have access until you actually hit it.
Right.
And how would you prevent that from happening? You have to almost have an exclusion list. The .NET Core version will actually take the whole C drive. It will just skip the folders you don't have access to.
Right.
And so I was showing that the .NET Core version is faster, but the .NET Core version is also more correct. Now, I can't take the .NET Core version of that and put it in .NET Framework because that would fundamentally change the behavior. Somebody might be depending on
that you fault on a folder that you don't have rights to.
On something I don't have access to.
Exactly.
And so it kind of highlights that kind of point that we can change stuff in Core because of the side-by-sides that we can't in .NET Framework. But I want to finish that question, that 4.8 question.
Sure.
I want to make sure that people understand that 4.8 or .NET Framework is not going anywhere.
No. Windows depends on it.
There is no plan to ever retire that framework. We're not going to stop fixing bugs in that framework. We're not going to stop making small additions to that framework.
Yeah.
But the ask from our customers has been, don't break my apps.
Yeah.
So because it's a globally installed thing, I think what you're going to see as we move more workloads to Core, it means those workloads will evolve on Core, and they'll stay where they are on .NET Framework, because we're trying to protect all those applications that are out there that rely on that globally installed version of .NET Framework.
Well, you said this in your overview talk as well. You're talking about the WinForms for high DPI and how implementing that against the traditional WinForms implementation broke people's apps.
We never did some of it because of that.
Right.
The reality is, the problem with high DPI is WinForms was designed to have one pixel being one pixel.
Right.
And pixels are really small on modern monitors.
Sure. 27-inch 4K screen, those are little pixels.
The only way to fix it is to scale stuff.
Right.
If you scale stuff, it's not going to be in the same place as it was before.
Exactly.
And so could you just imagine pixels kind of move around in somebody's apps, and we've seen this happen before. So I have two choices. One is I give you like 35 switches to turn on or off some of those fixes, those scaling fixes. Or I just say, no, don't change it here. Change it in .NET Core, which means if you want to take on 3.0.1 or 3.0.2 or 3.1, we can make the right changes. And it also means that the Core version won't be as ugly because I don't have to have all those compat switches all over the place.
Right. And so if somebody wants to take advantage of the high DPI stuff, they're going to have to go through the work.
If you want the full high DPI at some point with all the controls, you would have to be on the Core version because I promise you grid views are going to move around.
Yep.
Property sheets are going to move around. Stuff's going to move a little bit because scaling will be involved. And there's no magic way to solve that other than to have your old apps look this small on a
tiny,
big screen.
Tiny screens, yeah.
But 4.8 won't be the last, but our plan will be to do what we've done the last couple of years, which is make small incremental changes, fix bugs, keep the apps running on it, and for new developers, if you're really modernizing an app, I would say move to Core.
Right. And where you make something that can be ported, you will port.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fair. It's an interesting balancing act, no question.
It's hard.
There's no simple solutions. Beth, I don't want to leave you out
of it. No, I mean, I think to that point, though, historically, the .NET team has always been super compatible with their releases of .NET framework. And
it's like, sort of a Microsoft mantra.
It really is. It's sort of like in our blood. Forward. We don't like, and language too. I mean, you can't just break people like you're saying. Like, you have to port the right. bugs, you know? We all rely on it. We rely on a globally installed framework. We rely on the fact that we're going to get bug fixes, but we really don't want our apps breaking. So like Scott said, that's definitely a high priority for us. So
to a fault though.
Yeah.
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 There's things in .NET Framework that we don't like.
You can't.
But we just
can't.
Leave them in there and say, you know, you shouldn't use them, but they're still there.
Right. Yeah.
I would think in the core world, if we made a mistake and put something in that really should not be there, one or two major versions down the pipe, we would take that thing out.
Well, I'm super excited about .NET Core 3, only in, you know, even though it's a roadmap announcement, it's like, here's what we're going to do. I wanted self-contained EXEs back in 2002, dude. I mean, really. I mean, like, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's like, finally, it's like, oh. And side by side. I mean, I guess disk space was kind of expensive back in 2000, but, you know, I mean, it's not like that anymore.
No.
But with the linker, I mean, I feel like we're really moving, like you don't, like you said, you could change the car's engine out, but it's still my car. It's still my WPF app. It's still my WinForms app. I mean, this is a huge thing to think about. If you think about, like, not breaking that compatibility, that's number one. My app still runs, but now it runs in a way that I wanted it to run in the first place, side by side, self-contained, don't break anything. I mean, that's really going to be amazing, I think.
I've got to think in a larger organization where they have literally thousands of .NET apps, and they may have been strung by, I've got to stick with this version that I know works. You know, when we try and compile up, it breaks things. That they're going to start taking advantage of this, be able to go through that catalog of applications and start looking at what can I turn into a completely compiled app? Where can I use side by side so that I'm no longer bound to those versions? I have a little more control.
What we find when we talk to customers, and I know a customer that has 12,000 .NET applications.
That's a lot of apps, man.
In their organization, actually, 12,000, 1,200.
12,000.
Both are big numbers.
I mean, I've dealt with my IT hat on. I've worked with infrastructures where it was thousands of apps, but I haven't had 12,000.
What they told us was about 300 of those apps they're still working on.
Wow.
The other, let's say, 700 or 800 of them, they're not working on, and they just want those to continue to run as they are.
Yep.
And those 300 would be the ones they would move to core.
Those are ones that are actually going to migrate. The rest they want to make sure stay stable.
They stay stable. And right. So their ask to us has been, don't make lots of changes in .NET Framework, because every time you make a change, even fixing a bug, as we just talked about.
Yep.
If you fix that file enumeration bug that we fixed in core in .NET Framework,
you're going to change somebody's behavior.
What's going to break.
And it's not like it's going to pop up an error message. It's just going to behave differently suddenly.
We had a case years ago where calling a certain API loaded an Office DLL. And then people assumed that they could just p-invoke into the Office DLL.
Because it was always there.
And then one framework version, we said, oh, we're not going
to load
that Office DLL anymore.
Yeah.
And bugs started flowing in. It's like, hey, I'm getting exceptions when I p-invoke into this code.
And it used to work with the old version. Why doesn't it work with the new version?
And they took a dependency on something we never documented or said you should do.
That's right.
There's so many instances of this.
Yeah, all of those subtle things.
Small things can break a lot of stuff.
I don't know if you remember, Mads, when Roslyn really started taking off, did you find a few that you missed? Like people that apps used to work, now we're switching to the new C# base and they had problems?
It happened quite a lot, but mercifully, most of them were caught before we were like totally in production.
Right.
We were worried about it up until the last minute. We had a plan B in our pocket to switch back to the old compiler, if people didn't upgrade to the latest language version, they could still compile with the old compiler and so on. We were worried about it, but I think we had a point in time, we did very gradual adoption of it. We adopted it inside of Microsoft, the Roslyn-based compiler, way before it was actually RTM
right.
to the world. And
you guys lived with it quite a while.
Yeah, we had a thing that we called, we flipped the big switch. We had a party and everything. We got the T-shirt. when we flipped the big switch, Anders actually clicked the switch at a team meeting. And we were like, nothing happened. We're all good. We're still functional.
We're still alive.
And that's when we had the confidence that, OK, this is going to go well.
I think it's one of the interesting truths that I just not always visible to the outside world. It's like, you talk about how the .NET framework will never leave Windows, because a bunch of Windows is written with .NET.
Yeah, like, that's
They consume the company consumes its own stuff.
One of the funny questions that I got, we were doing some before the .NET Core 3 announced today, we'd actually tested with many externals under NDA. And one of the pieces of feedback always was, I'm losing my mind here. thinking about something else. What was the question? I've really lost my train of thought.
The pieces of Windows that actually run using.
Yeah, .NET. A lot of people asked us. We'd actually on one of these dry runs, we had said that .NET Framework would be supported as long as Windows.
Sure.
And somebody asked me, well, that means when Windows 11 ships, there won't be a .NET Framework in it. And I'm like,
the VB runtime that really hasn't been worked on since '99.
VB runtime is still in
Windows. Still ships with Windows.
The original ASP.NET web framework is still in there.
Right.
And you know, .NET Framework will be in there forever. And as
forever.
I said, if you use the IIS manager in Windows, that's running .NET. There are so many pieces of Windows that are .NET based. There's no way to decouple the things. Nor would we ever try. There's no point.
No reason to. It's a waste of time. This is a dependency that you actually count on.
Should we try to grab some questions?
Absolutely. And it's another Stuart Quinn question. Stuart's a regular listener to my show, as well as Shuri Ketchaloth of Channel 9. And it's a great question talking about deployment of desktop apps. Because I think it's one of the challenges is how are we getting apps out the door in these new models?
So at Build, if you watch some of the Windows talks, they're going to introduce something called MSIX.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a new version of the MSI format. And the idea behind MSIX is any kind of app, whether it's a Win32, whether it's a .NET framework, a .NET Core, a UWP, can all be packaged in this, and it's a zip file with a manifest.
Nice.
And customers are going to have the choice of actually installing the MSIX or putting it into the Windows Store.
I like that topic enough, I grabbed Andrew to do an interview for .NET Rocks here at
Good.
Build.
Because you guys should do a talk on that.
Absolutely.
But, we don't plan in the .NET team to build a new click once or anything like that. We would basically leverage on whatever the Windows team is putting together, and a combination of the MSIX plus what they've been calling Centennial historically, which lets you sandbox your applications. I think that really is the install story moving forward, and what I'd recommend customers to. If you get your app into those states and into the store, then you know you push to the store and all the desktops update versus trying to shove exes around the network yourself,
right.
Trying to shove DLLs around by yourself.
A little sneaker netting, any of that sort of traditional install mechanism.
And with these self-contained .NET Core apps we were just talking about at the session where you can actually build a single exe that contains WinForms and .NET Core, that installation model is perfect. If there's a security problem, you put a new one in the store, all the desktops update. You don't have to worry about installing a .NET framework on the boxes and stuff like that.
And getting mixed up versions, any of those sort of DLL hell challenges.
I think the combo of the Windows guy, what the Windows team's doing, and what we're doing with .NET Core 3 are going to make install experiences easier.
I think it's a very powerful aspect of what you said there, that the responsibility for the installer is taken with Windows rather than being part of the .NET team per se. That it's ultimately Windows and Windows' rules for how software is supposed to execute in the context of the operating system. So they own the installer.
Yeah, and I think Windows wants to give the customer even more control. It's like, you want your app to run in a sandbox where it can't see network shares,
right.
Where it can't see temp folders or stuff like that. I think every admin wants to be able to have those fine controls. That's not something we would build as a .NET team.
Yeah, that I would like as an IT person to have a manifest around every installation and know what they're expecting, what they require, and what I'm prepared to give them or not give them.
The Windows team built a lot of that into UWP, mm-hmm. but I think you're going to see those sandbox controls that UWP run into flowing back to all apps. That's kind of what this Centennial effort's been about.
So it doesn't matter where the app came from.
We're a platform. What I tell people all the time is we're no different than Java or Node or Python or anybody else. We don't want to go and put a bunch of weird rules in the framework for a particular platform.
Sure.
It should be the platform that sets the rules.
Well, especially when you're thinking about Core and you do need to deploy apps to a Linux box or to a Mac, and they have a different security model and different requirements, and that dependency has to be handled there.
Right.
That makes total sense to me. More future? What comes next?
Well, you know what I'm personally excited about, mm-hmm. besides .NET Core 3? The fact that we have 1 million more active developers this year than we did over last year, just in Visual Studio.
Wow.
So the fact that .NET is growing like fast still to this day is just super encouraging, and it's a testament to all the great work that this team does and the community
and interesting
and the open
studio,
source nature of what we have today. I mean, really, I think when we like pushed that button on stage, remember like Roslyn open source and announced the .NET Foundation, and I think pigs were flying and people didn't believe it. And it's, you know, almost 5 years later, it's 4.5 years later, right?
Yep.
And we really have had a cultural shift, like across the entire ecosystem is happening, right? And I think you could just see that in the number of sheer number of people that are coming to the platform. And the other thing is, you know, just people downloading .NET Core itself, like, you know, a lot are students, mm-hmm. you know, and this is just, this is the future, right? You know, we're, you know, going on 16 years old, right? Well, guess what? I am very confident we'll have another great 16 years coming. I'm just seeing this incredible growth, and I'm really super excited about it. I just don't think it would have happened if we didn't open source and go cross-platform.
Hanselman mentioned on stage that when you say, you know, new developers, that's not just I tried it one day and uninstalled it or I downloaded it. These are people that are actually using the product multiple times a month for multi-minute sessions each time they use it. So I want to be clear, these are not just tire kicker people.
They're
not just installs.
Yeah. They're not downloads, not an install, right. but a usage. Yeah.
Interesting.
And I agree with Beth. I think the .NET Core revolutions brought a refreshing rebirth to .NET.
A new set of developers.
For a new set of developers, for new types of problems, on new types of platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Is how
you can literally build anything with .NET. I mean, talk about productivity, compatibility, and anything. It's a very, very compelling platform.
Who would have thought 5 years ago that a 2018 Samsung TV, the dashboard would be .NET.
Yeah, all the Q-series TVs are running Tizen 4, which
but
is
But it's Tizen under the
4.
Hood. It's not like they adopted Windows or anything.
Tizen supports .NET Core.
You're running .NET Core on Tizen.
Write a Xamarin Forms app and run it on your television. I'm buying one, by the way.
Yeah, one of the things I'm really thankful about now is that we've kept up the innovation pace in the language and on the platform. In the framework across all these years, even as we've gone through these changes and had to build new things from scratch, like .NET Core and so on, we've kept up an innovation pace, which means that we don't like come out of this whole reconfiguration, now have to catch up to where the industry is now. And that means that, at least from my biased point of view, I think we still feel fresh, like we still feel like we're on point. Even as we've gone through these convolutions. And that means we come out really strong now that the .NETs are coming together and are all set, yes, for another 16 times 16 years.
The Blazors effect, just sort of seeing C# running through WASM right in the browser, and this idea of browsers just being host for whatever language you care for, I think we're going to see more of these.
I think so, too. The reason that's popular is the browser is a sandbox.
Yeah, already deployed.
An app that runs in the browser, deployment's easy.
Mm-hmm.
You just click a link and the app loads in the browser. The browser can limit what the app can actually do to the machine. And I think the WebAssembly models, you're gonna see Java, .NET, Python, all these other languages are gonna jump, Go. They're all gonna jump in the browser.
Sure.
And it's gonna be, I think it's a new way of building apps. I'll be honest with you. I was traveling last week when Blazor 0.3 came out.
Yep.
And one of the demos that we did in the overview session blew my mind. It was that demo was something I was doing in my hotel room, and I'm like, I have an HTML element, and I'm there's like on mouse over, which you normally would write some JavaScript for. I can put C# there.
Yes.
It blew my mind. I move my mouse over something and the text changes immediately. There's no
load time,
post back.
Drawing.
And I wrote no JavaScript at all. It's like I can be so productive. I would have had to find a library back in the day. It would have been jQuery that knew how to find an element and change the text.
So what turns it from an experimental project into a mainstream thing for Microsoft?
We need feedback from customers that this is a thing that will grow .NET.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's two things. I think of Blazor in two ways. We want to make sure that .NET is innovative. MADS is always looking at how to make C# look like a leading language. We're not resting on our laurels on C#. We're not going to say we're done. No, he's going to look at what problems happen in the future and how best to tackle them from a language perspective. To me, Blazor is saying, hey, we know that the browser is this really popular place to build applications, and historically it's been HTML applications, but it might be something different in the future.
Sure.
And we want to make sure .NET is there,
right there,
on the bleeding edge.
One of the things that I really enjoyed from that overview talk was the flipping of a link query into a for each. Like, however you care to read a piece of code, it does exactly the same thing. It's just two different expressions.
That was feedback from customers. So those, mm-hmm. when you see those features are probably in Mads' dev team, I'm going to guess you have some people like this. They're like, you should not be using link. You'll find, just like you shouldn't be using var. There'll be some people that say you shouldn't be using link. There's
right.
always a group of somebodies. And it's pretty cool when the tool can actually flip your code away from something you don't like. But at the same time, I don't want to take anything away from link. Link is freaking awesome.
Yeah, no, very powerful. But it's sometimes so dense. Like I think you did a great example there, where you're looking. I remember studying the link as you were describing, going, what exactly does that do? And then you flipped it to for each. You go, well, that's what it does.
We have a similar problem with Entity Framework. A lot of folks will write some EF Core code and write some what looks to them like a beautiful query.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't think about what actually that's translated to before it actually hits the database, it might look really small and compact in your code.
For you, but SQL Server is going to see it very differently.
Might go, you just maybe run, you know, scan the entire database to make the result of this. And that's,
yeah.
in the case of EF Core, we've done a lot of work to make it where it's easy to turn on a feature where you can see the actual real SQL that's going to happen as you, in Visual Studio, you can hover your mouse over the query.
Nice.
And it'll pop up in a tooltip and show you the actual SQL that will be generated there.
That's just smart tooling in terms of letting people stay productive.
I
love that the Visual Studio numbers are up, but I think we're remiss if we don't talk about VS Code a little.
Yeah,
the traction there is stunning,
and just the CLI itself, mm-hmm. too, right? Like mm-hmm. .NET Core CLI, the SDK itself. Like
the CLI's exploded so much we don't know how to count it.
We're
struggling.
You're
going to
go
problems.
Throw me under the bus there, aren't you? Yeah, I literally was trying to come up with this beautiful slide for Scott, and I'm like, I can't.
We don't know the intent of what you do with the CLI.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we don't know if, are we seeing crazy CLI numbers because you have a build system that's running the CLI as part of CI/CD?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you actually developing and building an app using the CLI? And so we think our CLI numbers are actually exaggerated because of its usage everywhere. And so that's why there's no magic mechanism for us to go, that's a developer, or that's a build machine.
Yeah, that's a build stream. Because if you're in a build stream with a significant group of people doing CI, that code's running almost continuously. Every time they're checking in anything, it's running again.
But that said, you know, in the .NET Core wave, you know, from March of last year to March of this year, you know, we're pretty confident that we have a million .NET Core developers in that time frame.
Nice.
Which is pretty amazing to go from zero to a million in a year. That's and a cool part of that is there's a nice percentage of those that never used .NET before.
Yeah.
Meaning that they're net news, and
yeah.
that's really what our hope is with the platform is to bring new developers.
What's the appeal for a new developer looking at this language now? I mean, of course, we've all been in this long enough that our views are very distorted, I think. But to have someone brand new come in and see it, like, what are they seeing?
It's funny. We ask ourselves that question all the time. In fact, John Mont, who was out there earlier, my boss, we were laughing because the same things that we sold .NET on originally are probably the same things I would sell it on today. Productivity.
Yeah.
Meaning, you know, you saw Hanselman demoing some of the tools that we have in Visual Studio where you want to change this code, light bulb shows up or a wrench shows up and your screwdriver shows up, you click it, boom. So I think it's having some of the best tooling. We've been trying to make .NET be one of the most performant frameworks on the planet. That's one. I think we have one of the most elegant languages out there. And I think, you know, Anders and Mads for that.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that I think appeal, and it runs everywhere. It's open source. You don't have to pay for it. That's
fast.
I think there's one more thing.
It's really fast.
Which was also around when we first started, which is that as a company, we have a huge amount of commitment to .NET.
Mm-hmm.
Like everybody can see we're investing heavily and we're in it for the long haul. I think there's been periods of time where people haven't maybe fully believed in our commitment to .NET as a company. And for the last certainly half a decade, we've turned that up to 11, and everybody can see that I can bet on .NET, and I'm going to be happy 5 years, 10 years from now that I did that.
Each time you guys consume your own stuff, it gets dramatically better.
Like that's true.
When Studio 2010, for the struggles that it had, but it used WPF, And WPF 4 was a substantial improvement over the previous versions. Every time I see that, I go, oh, well, they're real serious about this. Like, that's important to them. They're kicking it around, and they're committed to it. Like, the products they sell depend on the stuff they're building.
Yeah, the openness we have is great in that we get quick feedback, but there's nothing like dogfooding.
Yeah.
Like, actually using it the day after you put it in and feeling the pain because you did something wrong.
And you know those guys are in the next building owner, and you can hunt them down.
Yeah.
Well, it's not just our own creations here that we're getting these amazing contributions towards. Mm-hmm. It's also the fact that we're seeing our ecosystem also expand in new ways. For instance, microservices architectures, right? Mm-hmm. Seeing some of the projects in the .NET Foundation filling gaps in some of those areas too. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we have over 60 projects there now. And it's like about, you know, helping the broader ecosystem also fill gaps that we maybe can't get to right now. You know, like ML.NET was just announced today, right? And that's a machine learning for .NET. We starting this project right out in the open, just boom, okay. And integrating with libraries that are already trying to fill this gap, right?
Sure.
So it's just we have some gaps, we do. We still have a long way to go, but it's gonna be hand in hand with the community, and
but
I think that's really exciting.
ML.NET. Even if you think you're calling it 0.01 release or
0.1
release.
0.1.
You've been using it internally for some time. Like, there's a bunch of your products that depend on it. Thanks for surfacing it to us, because I think we're going to have some fun with it.
It's actually a really fun project because we've had strong machine learning technology inside of Microsoft for a while now, and we used it in some of our top-tier products. Most of the intelligent behavior you see in various office products and all over the place in Bing. It's based on it, but it's been in an internal secret sauce. And now we're offering it up as a .NET library that we're committed to evolving with the community into, it already is one of the strongest machine learning frameworks probably on the planet, one that does the most work at scale. It's just nobody ever knew, and now, the thing for us is just to make it consumable to developers, because machine learning is one of those things that has been, it has sort of been walled off for mostly data scientists to they do their magic, they come with a model, and then the developer integrates into that model somehow to get predictions.
Right.
But more and more developers want to do their own machine learning, and you gotta put the machine learning tools where the developers are.
Right.
You can't, rely on some other tech or some other person over there doing the machine learning or the data science-y part for you. Developers want to do it on their own.
Yeah, it's going to be a mainstream part of the way we build code going forward.
Yeah. A cool part of ML.NET to me is watching Mads and Emo and other folks on the team take the APIs. One of the strengths, I think, of the .NET team is, you know, historically, WinForms. Man, that seems easy to use. Well, you took HWind and a Windows Win32 component, and you wrote elegant code on top of it to make it easy to use. And I think .NET's always taken Windows APIs and made them very easy to use. And so it's been fun. I've actually been able to watch some of the ML.NET stuff where, you know, you look at how it was internally. Of course, it was all used by, as Mads was saying, AI people.
Right.
Our job is to democratize it to regular developers.
You've always done.
Have the BCL team work on helping clean those APIs up, make them human consumable.
Yeah.
At one point, the GitHub demo we showed, the code was so bad that I was not going to show it. And I'm like, oh, well, we skipped through the slide. There was a slide of some GUI, because we're going to have a GUI as well.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, well, that code is so complicated, we'll just show the GUI and say, we'll generate the code for you.
Nice.
But the team's already cleaned up the APIs enough that some of them are pretty consumable.
Yeah, I mean, that said, there's a reason why it's a 0.1. Which is that we're just starting this work, and we want to invite the ML community that already is heavily invested in this direction, as well as the broader set of developers that we hope will feel the benefits of democratizing ML. We want these people involved early so that we can reach the the permanent shape of these APIs in a collaboration.
I think it's going to be a challenging balance between the experienced ML people who think in a data science way mm-hmm. and may approach it very differently from a typical .NET developer
yes.
who clearly needs to learn some things and embrace it. Like, what that balance will ultimately look like, I couldn't tell you, and I bet you're still figuring it out too.
We're figuring it out, but I bet that with the help of the community, of all these communities, as well as the internal experts we have, I think we'll get to a good place. By the time it's called 1.0, I think it's going to be amazing.
Please. And it definitely, to me, feels like that's a future-looking way of .NET, that these yes. are the skills we're going to bring in. The same way that these earlier versions of .NET kept adding in additional abilities. This is the next wave of ability. I think I'm going to leave it there. Beth, Mads, Scott, thank you so much for your time. It's really been fun talking to everyone, and I hope you enjoyed it. We're coming after you from Build, and we'll be back with more.